This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk/Sunday. I'm Roger Bolton. Welcome to Sunday. Good morning and welcome to Sunday. If it feels like 6:10, it was yesterday, but the clocks have moved forward. On this week's programme, we ask if military rabbis in the Israeli Defence Force told their soldiers that the war in Gaza was a holy one and that the Palestinians were Gentiles who needed to be cleared out of the Holy Land. We'll discuss whether homosexuality is an illness, which some mental health professionals still seem to think it is. And we'll talk to the priest who baptised the dying Jade Goody.
I saw there a reaching out to Jesus in actually wanting to get baptised. She'd spoken of wanting her children to come to know Jesus. I think in situations like this, you accept people's faith, whatever level it is at.
Some of the stories in this edition of Sunday. Bishop Michael Nazir Ali was once regarded as a possible Archbishop of York or even of Canterbury. He later became one of the leaders of GAFCON, a conservative, biblically-based grouping within the Anglican Communion opposed to gay priests. Now, at the relatively young age of 59, he has announced he will step down as Bishop of Rochester in the summer. Why? I'm now joined by Riazat Butt, the Guardian religious affairs correspondent. Good morning.
Morning, Roger.
Well, the bishop could have stayed another 10 years. Why is he going now?
Well, I mean, the speculation has already started about why he's going and why he's going now. As you said, he was touted as a possible contender. It's something that he never denied, and he never expressed his displeasure at being associated with those two offices. So I don't think it's sour grapes, and if it is, then it's about sort of 6 or 7 years after the event. He says that he wants to work with sort of Christian minorities, so he may feel that he wants to return to his roots. Maybe he thinks that being based in the field is better than being based in an office in Rochester somewhere.
Well, he's always been particularly concerned about the relationship between Christians and Muslims and on the whole believes that Christians haven't been stuck up for enough. And he's made some statements which seem to be quite critical of Islam and this government's attitude. Do you think that underpins some of his views for, or reasons for moving on?
The case, and it's very strange that he hasn't done that in this country and he's decided to move abroad to stick up for the rights of persecuted Christians.
What, to Pakistan, where he was born?
Yes, because he hasn't really done much bridge building here. He has made some really controversial statements that have annoyed some people within the Church of England, but have also annoyed people who work in race relations, for example. And it feels like he's left quite a lot of work undone here. But he's decided to move overseas anyway.
Now, will he have disappointed those in the Church of England who saw him as one fighting for traditional values in the Church and indeed in the wider Anglican Communion?
He does have a huge fan base, but it may be that by leaving the office of the Bishop of Rochester, he's able to speak more freely and he's actually able to associate himself more closely with things like the Global Anglican Future Conference that he may not have been able to do if he'd continued working within the Church of England.
You sound as if you don't think this is a leaving of the public stage.
No, I don't think so. I mean, he's always been known for making headlines, and even though I'm not a fan of his, I think this is the most exciting thing he's done in years. So I don't think we're going to see the last of him, and whether you're on the Conservative wing or whether you're a persecuted Christian, I think you'll definitely see more of Michael Nazir Ali.
Riazat Butt, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Roger.
Now, today, Turkey goes to the polls in nationwide local elections, which will help determine whether the country moves towards an Islamic version of democracy and away from a more secular one. The predominantly Kurdish southeast, and in particular Diyarbakir, the largest city in that region, is seen as the key for the ruling Islamic-rooted AK party. In the last general election, they scored a shock victory over the pro-Kurdish Democratic Society Party, or DTP, and are aiming to repeat it by seizing control of the city. But the DTP are fighting back, in particular focusing on women's rights. Dorian Jones reports from Diyarbakir.
Earlier this month, over 50,000 people gathered in the heart of Diyarbakir to commemorate the birth of Muhammad. Speakers at the meeting, to rapturous applause, condemned Israel and Jews. It was the largest religious gathering the city has seen in living memory. One of those attending was 40-year-old Ahmed.
Every year this meeting is getting bigger. In the past, only a few villagers would come, but now most of the villagers are coming. People are again becoming more and more aware of their religion.
The predominantly Kurdish southeast of Turkey has traditionally been amongst the most religious regions in the country. That was until the more than 20-year-long insurgency by the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, which is fighting the Turkish state for Kurdish autonomy. Their pro-Marxist, pro-secular stance saw the power of religion wane. But with its influence in the last few years starting to ebb, religion is starting to reassert itself. Kurdish writer Kavan Emir.
We have a literary, we have a political movement of modernizing Kurdish society, Kurdish literature for the last 30 years. There has been guerrilla war, and also there has been the legal movements, legal struggles. And at the beginning it was leftist, it was Marxist. There were some liberal groups, some villagers, some progressive people. And they had a kind of collaboration with the Turkish leftist groups. Intellectuals were supporting that movement. Secularism is really important for the Kurdish movement. 50 years ago, it was conservative, but it had started to change. But now there's a reverse.
Hey, kardeş, benden birkaç nasihat istedin.
At a meeting of a tarikat, worshippers listen as Mohammed Akkar gives a religious reading. Tarikats are Muslim brotherhoods. Some have as many as 250,000 followers in the region. They're very wealthy, providing free food, coal, and even education to the poor. They're now using their influence in support of the ruling Islamic-rooted Justice and Development Party, or AKP. In the 2007 general election, they helped the AKP to score a shock victory over the pro-Kurdish Democratic Society Party, the DTP, pushing the party into second place. Now the goal, as Akkar explains, is the control of Diyarbakir, dubbed by the Turkish media as the castle of Kurdish nationalism.
Bu seçimde de bölgedeki dindar kesim, belki tarikatlar ve cemaatler.
I strongly believe in all the different Islamic sects, Islamic communities and all the talikats will support the Prime Minister's AK party very strongly. Because the party is offering a policy of bringing shared beliefs between all the people and different cultures. A bond that has existed for 1,000 years.
But there is a reaction to the growing influence of religion, none more so than from women. In a show of force in defence of women's rights, thousands of women gathered in the heart of the city to mark International Women's Day. It was a strictly women-only affair, with the only male exception allowed to attend, the DTP's candidate for mayor, Osman Baydemir. Women play a central role in his party, with a 40% quota for women for all candidates and party positions. His administration has opened up numerous women's centres and shelters. Baydemir is now looking to women to counter the growing religious vote.
Yerel yönetim anlayışımızın ana.
One of the ideological pillars of our party and local government is the rights of women. We see that we're making the whole of society more free when we make women more active in social, political and economic life. But this does not mean we're against religion, which is what the Justice and Development Party is trying to do. We respect everyone's rights to their religious beliefs, whether it's Alevis, Sunnis or Christians and Jews, and people are now understanding this.
In the last few days of frantic campaigning, Baydemir is seeking every opportunity to get his message across to women, visiting a centre where women can do their laundry while at the same time receive education. He promises, if elected, to share his position with a woman. Listening is Mule Ser.
The Kurdish Democratic Society Party is the only party that gives importance to the struggle of women for freedom and equality. My neighbourhood is the biggest in Diyarbakir, and it has a local woman mayor, and she is standing again. She says, I remember in the past when a religious party was last in power here. They shut down all the women's centres. It will be a disaster for women if they come to power again.
But such accusations are angrily denied by the Islamic-rooted Justice and Development Party, which says it too is committed to improving women's representation, although it has no women candidates for senior posts in the city. Whatever the result of this Sunday's poll, the recriminations and deep divisions are expected to continue, with two powerful forces of secularism and religion set to continue to battle for control and influence. Unless they can learn to live with one another, the region, which has already endured 2 decades of conflict, could face the prospect of a new confrontation.
Dorian Jones reporting from Turkey. The very public death, the very public death of the reality TV star Jade Goody has divided the country. Some feel they've lost a friend and want to be part of a public mourning, the like of which we haven't seen since the death of Princess Diana in very different circumstances. Others are baffled by the attention given to someone who, in their view, was not especially talented and who did not achieve anything of significance. The church was drawn into this debate when, shortly before her death, Miss Goody asked to be baptised. The service was conducted by the Reverend Corin Brixton, Associate Minister of St John's Church, Buckhurst Hill in Essex, who will also be officiating at the funeral next weekend. I asked her how she came to know Jade Goody.
I only actually met Jade for the first time at the baptism. In fact, that was the only time that I met her during the actual service itself, and just very briefly afterwards. But she had stated a desire to get baptised or christened at the church where I'm associate minister in Buckhurst Hill. And I also have some contacts with Jack's family as well.
Did you have any qualms about conducting the baptism service?
No, I didn't actually. I had a bit of time just to kind of step back and think about it beforehand. And the question I simply asked myself is, what would I do in any other situation like this? And the answer was quite simply, of course, I'd go ahead and do it.
In doing so, did you have to accept the genuineness of Jade's views about Christianity or conversion to it? Or was it your view that that was her business? Your responsibility was simply to provide her with that service?
I think from what I'd read about Jade and heard about her, I saw there a reaching out to Jesus in actually wanting to get baptised. She'd spoken of wanting her children to come to know Jesus. And that was enough for me. I think in situations like this, you accept people's faith, whatever level it is at. Obviously, in the case of normal baptisms, we would spend time with the people getting baptised or the parents explaining exactly what's involved in baptism. But in situations like this, there's just a huge pastoral need just to be there for the family and accept their faith at whatever level it's at.
Now, a lot of people, and it may be a generational divide in this country, have taken very different views about the publicity surrounding Ms. Goody's death. And some feel it, in a way, offensive to die so publicly. Do you think it serves a purpose or can serve a purpose to have such a public death?
I think it does very much. I think we live in a society that very often denies death, doesn't like to think about it, would avoid it, talking about it, thinking about it at any cost. And I think this brings, you know, what is, at the end of the day, a very real reality of life home to people, and I think particularly to young people as well. So I think it has done something very important, and I think it was very courageous of her to be willing to go through her period of illness in such a public way. I think it sent out a very powerful message.
Now, you've decided to open a book of condolences in the church. Presumably, a number of people who will sign that won't have known her personally, will only have known her as a television reality star. So what's the function of such a book?
I think that although people have only known Jade through television, through what they've read, I think because of the character that she is and the way that, I think particularly the publicity surrounding her illness, people do feel in a very real way that they know her. And obviously people have been touched by her death. I mean, so many people have just said to me just what a tragedy they feel it to be. And obviously in situations of grief, people do feel a need to express that in some way. And we really hope that obviously being able to pass on the books of condolences to the family afterwards will really touch them as they read more about just how much Jade meant to ordinary people in this country.
But as mentioned, there's a generational divide, I think, and a lot of older people will say or feel that death should be a private matter, and they'd see this as death as showbiz.
I don't think death can ever be showbiz, actually. I don't think it can be trivialised in a situation like this. Some people may feel that that's the case, but having encountered the family and encountered the people who have come to sign the Book of Condolence, this isn't trivial.
The Reverend Corin Brixton. Now, the Spanish Socialist Government and the country's Roman Catholic Church are in a head-on confrontation, and the cause is a proposed new abortion law which would allow abortions up to 22 weeks and which also contains a provision that would allow girls over 16 to have an abortion without parental consent. I'm now joined by the BBC's Danny Wood in Madrid. Danny, what's the present law on abortion in Spain?
Well, the current legislation was introduced in 1985, and under that law, women can get abortions, but it's offered only under restricted circumstances. Currently, most of those abortions which are carried out in private clinics within the first 14 weeks of the pregnancy require a doctor's diagnosis that the pregnancy is a risk to the woman's mental health, and the doctor and the woman can be prosecuted if that's not the case.
And why has the government decided to change the law to liberalise it?
Well, the government, supported by recommendations from its own panel of experts, says it wants to change the abortion law to bring it into line with the rest of Europe. It says it's not about making a more permissive law, it's about making a more secure law that gives women and doctors better legal protection, because one of the problems under this law is that the doctor and the woman can actually be prosecuted. And this has happened. Doctors have been arrested. In early 2008, doctors were arrested in raids on abortion clinics in Barcelona and Madrid and accused of falsifying doctor certificates. So under this new law, it would make sure that doesn't happen, because women would be able to have abortions on demand during the first 14 weeks.
Well, the church is implacably opposed to it, not just in Spain, of course, elsewhere. But in Spain, how much support does the church now have? I think there's going to be a demonstration today. How many supporters do you think they'll get out?
Well, there are likely to be tens of thousands on the streets of Madrid and also other cities all over Spain. And certainly the church does have support from perhaps 30% of the Spanish population, a core of conservatives, and also family associations and anti-abortion lobby groups. But the numbers they bring in are almost directly related to the numbers in their congregations. They'll quite literally be bussing them in from all over Spain into Madrid.
And this is a dramatic change, of course, from what, 40 years ago. Spain suddenly seems to have made a rather extreme jump from being a highly religious to almost a secular country now.
That is true in some ways, yes. I think from inside the country, people tend to be quite surprised that that's the view from outside. Certainly the last 10 to 15 years, the country has liberalised a lot. But I think it's fair to say the socialist government with this sort of legislation does have the support of the majority of Spaniards.
Now, if this new law goes through, and it's likely to, is it just the first step in perhaps a number of collisions between church and state, which are in prospect?
It's the big one under this socialist government. They've already had quite a few. There are no more envisioned. I think they'll have enough trouble getting this one through the parliament. So no, this is likely to be the last big bit of legislation under this socialist government.
Danny Wood in Madrid, thanks very much. This is Sunday on BBC Radio 4. The time is now just coming up to 7:28. No, I'm not doing a Jack DeManio. The clocks have gone forward. Still to come. Is the present financial crisis a moral one as well? The Bishop of London tells us why he thinks it is. And is homosexuality treatable? Should it be? As research reveals that one in six mental health professionals say they've tried to cure patients of their homosexuality, we discuss whether they themselves need treatment. Those stories a little later in Sunday. It was inevitable that once the Israeli troops withdrew from Gaza, a propaganda war would replace the military one. But the latest criticism of the behaviour of the Israel Defence Force, the IDF, has come from within Israel itself. According to the head of the Yitzhak Rabin Military Academy, many Israeli troops were told that they were fighting a religious war against Gentiles. In a soldiers' forum at the academy, a combatant testified that the clear message of literature distributed to troops by the rabbinate was, and I quote, "We are the Jewish people. We came to this land by a miracle. God brought us back to this land, and now we need to fight to expel the Gentiles who are interfering with our conquest of this holy land." I asked the executive director of Rabbis for Human Rights in Israel, Rabbi Arik Asherman, how he felt when he heard the news.
The day that I heard about it, I cried, I started to fast, and ripped my shirt, which is a sign of Jewish mourning. I think that soldiers think of themselves, we killed civilians in cold blood, and that's what we felt we were being encouraged to do. I pray that I misunderstand this. I pray that there are extenuating circumstances and facts that we don't know that will put this all in a different light. But
can I ask you?
It's hard for me to believe that there isn't anything to this at all.
Can I ask you about the role of the military rabbis here? Because yes. Some of the soldiers have said that The Education Corps gave them a history of the conflict from 1948 onwards, but the rabbinate brought in a lot of booklets and articles, and their message was very clear, rather different. We are the Jewish people. We came to this land by a miracle. God brought us back to this land, and now we need to fight to expel the Gentiles who are interfering with our conquest of this holy land. In other words, they represent the conflict as a holy war. Do you agree with that?
It's even worse than that, to tell you the truth. Leading up to this war, we've heard some very disturbing evidence that the legal department of the military was basically co-opted into trying to justify anything the military would want to do, that the ethicists who work with the military, the same thing, and yes, even the army rabbinate, that they got into things that are just not their responsibility, sending material to soldiers, as you said, making this look like a holy war, talking about our historical right to the entire land of Israel, which is their right to believe that, I suppose, but not in their function to be giving that to soldiers. And worst of all, the material that they handed out basically justified akzariut, Hebrew for cruelty, arguing that in these kinds of cases, in order to save the lives of Israeli soldiers and fighting a terrorist enemy, that cruelty is permissible.
Finally, Rabbi, do you trust the IDF, the Israeli army, to investigate itself? Because this is what appears is going to happen.
No, I don't. They've been investigating. And again, the fact that the army was sitting with this testimony from soldiers for a month and did nothing about it shows that the code of you watch the back of your brothers in arms is simply too strong. They cannot do it. And if Israel really wants to have the most moral army in the world, and I would agree that we face tremendous moral challenges, which are not simple, and perhaps are acting more morally than some other armies. But if you really want to have the most moral army in the world, you have to start by saying, we have red lines, we have moral standards, and we will investigate them. We as a society take our own values seriously enough that we are going to prosecute, that we are going to do it, and whatever you find out, we are going to deal with. And unfortunately, you cannot expect the army to do that on its own.
Rabbi Arik Asherman of Rabbis for Human Rights in Israel. Major Avital Leibovich is spokesperson for the Israel Defense Force. I asked you if the allegations about the army rabbis were true.
There were one or two cases like this, and they were immediately treated in a disciplinary manner. And, of course, this is against IDF policy. There is no politics in the army. There is a very clear policy. We are here. We went to this operation to defend our country and nothing else. I mean, you know, in the IDF, we have Muslims serving. We have Druze. We have Circassians. We have Christians. This is an army of many religions. Therefore, I don't accept this at all.
But there are very specific allegations by these soldiers who are serving soldiers who've been in Gaza saying they received booklets with a very clear message that we are the Jewish people, we came to the land by a miracle, God brought us back to this land, and now we need to fight to expel the Gentiles who are interfering with our conquest of this holy land. This isn't just a one-off.
As I said, it was really very few cases. It was initiation of a few people, and no more than this. Does not represent whatsoever the IDF's policy.
But the concern is that with such advice coming from some rabbis, it reinforces the idea that Israeli soldiers need to pay little attention to the lives of the Palestinians, which are then regarded as very less important. And there are critics who say this is what happened in Gaza under great provocation.
Israel did take a great measure of prevention of civilian casualties. We took nearly 1 million phone calls to civilians' homes asking them to evacuate. We dropped approximately 500,000 leaflets from the air. We used the local media in order to warn the population. This actually, on an operational basis, causes us a lot of danger because, you know, you actually expose your next step and where are you going to attack next. So I believe that we did the utmost that we could in order to prevent civilian casualties.
But if you're so convinced of this case, why is it that the army won't allow an independent investigation into some of these allegations, both of the activities of the rabbis and of some of the soldiers? Why is it an internal investigation?
Well, the IDF, like any other army in the world, conducts its own investigation, just like the U.S. Army, the British Army, the French Army.
Yeah, and everybody watches their own backs. Everybody inevitably in the same organization has a joint desire to protect the organization, and that may get in the way of justice.
Well, I think that it's not obvious we're investigating. I didn't see Hamas investigating any of its war crimes. And we are here investigating and punishing the people that deserve it.
So finally, returning to the question of the rabbis in the military, what is their role? If you find in future rabbis who are saying this is a holy war, or that Israel exists to the boundaries of the Jordan and includes Gaza and so on, will you attempt to stop them doing that?
Well, look, the rabbinate unit is actually a small unit. It's a special unit that is destined to give an answer to the religious soldiers. By the way, we have an equivalent department that deals with the Muslims and the Druze. Of course, we won't have any politics in the IDF. All the soldiers, it doesn't matter what their religion are all acting at the same cause to defend our country. This is why the name of the army is the Israeli Defense Forces.
Major Avital Leibovich of the Israeli Defense Force. Later this week, the leaders of the world's most important economic powers, the G20, meet in London to try and coordinate their responses to the financial and economic crises which are affecting every country, capitalist, socialist or communist. But does the crisis have a moral and ethical dimension? Faith leaders certainly think so. And yesterday, they joined the demonstrations in London. Shazia Khan joined them.
Methodist Central Hall in Westminster, London, a special service is taking place calling on world leaders to put an end to global poverty. Around 2,000 people from churches and charities across the country have turned up here for this service. The Reverend Joel Edwards, International Director of MICA Challenge, a coalition of Christian organisations aimed at fighting global poverty, is one of the key speakers.
People are fundamentally made in God's image, and therefore every individual is due dignity and human rights.
He hopes through prayer and reflection, Christians will be inspired to take action to help the most vulnerable, and that a difference can be made.
I'm really drawn by a powerful parable in the Gospel of Luke. It's the story of a man who had a visitor who came at midnight, and he didn't have anything to give him to eat. So he went next door to a friend and said, "Hey, my friend has come from a long journey. I have nothing to give him to eat. Can you help me out here?" And this man has locked his door, he's gone to bed, and he refuses to help initially. Well, the man wears him down with his persistence. And eventually he has to give way. And I think what we're wanting to convey is this: a theology of transformation is prepared to go for the long haul. And we want to wear down injustice with our persistence. It's the impact of rain on a rock, wearing it away.
But Oliver Cam, a Times columnist and former investment banker, thinks the campaign's message is flawed. He says trade-offs have to be made in economics and that there's not always an obvious moral choice.
I think that there is a problem in the message they're giving. Economics is about, above all, the allocation of scarce resources to competing uses. And the message of the religious leaders about justice is, of course, an integral part of Christian witness. But in human affairs, not all good things are compatible, and not all aims are economically achievable. And a service and a march in favour of, for example, justice and jobs and climate change doesn't, to me, take account of the fact that aiming for economic growth is the most important part of improving people's lot, and it's not necessarily compatible with improving the environment at the same time.
God of infinite love and abundant generosity.
But for those at the service, their belief is resolute. They want decisions about the economy to be guided by what will help the world's poorest people. Father Joe Komakoma, a Catholic priest from Zambia and partner with the Christian charity CAFOD, knows firsthand how communities in his country are suffering.
I was born on the copper belt, that is the copper-producing region, and most of my family is still on the copper belt. And I've seen the copper belt at the time when, you know, copper was really, you know, fetching a good price, and, you know, in years past when it was a flourishing area and, you know, there were plenty of jobs going around and life was good. And now I see with the downturn how things have changed immediately, that with the job losses we are talking about, I see my nephews, I see my nieces who can't get a job.
He says world leaders and institutions have lost their moral compass.
If you see or look at the genesis of these current problems, it's now widely understood that it's because of the greed of some people And it's because we had so much faith in the financial markets and the market will regulate itself. That was the argument. And government should have no business in business. But see where it has brought us. Just because people lost that moral perspective and forgot that all this is about people in the first place. And because we let, you know, the market regulate itself and, you know, people who have their self-interest at heart, you know, to operate, then we are in a crisis.
After the service, those taking part join the tens of thousands of people that march through London towards Hyde Park as part of the Put People First rally. 35,000 people turned up in what is thought to be the first of many demonstrations that will take place over the next few days.
Shazia Khan reporting. This Tuesday in St Paul's Cathedral, the Bishop of London, Richard Charters, will be chairing a debate between a leading cabinet member and other world leaders ahead of the G20 meeting. Bishop Richard joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's very difficult, watching the news reports yesterday, perhaps even listening to that report, to detect a coherent or unifying message coming from these demonstrations. Do you have one?
Well, I think there are many perspectives. Unifying message on Tuesday is going to be rebuilding trust, because one of the crucial things is that there is inevitably a moral dimension to trying to organise the global economy, and the Prime Minister has been going around South America recently saying just that. I think one of the most important things that we want to emphasise is that we've signed ourselves up to the Millennium Development Goals. These are the UN goals to alleviate extreme poverty. We've set ourselves deadlines, and at a time of financial turbulence, we ought not to forget the promises we've made. And I think also, just coming to a point that was made by one of your previous speakers, it's all very well to say we've got to go for growth, but as he also said in that statement, we've got to recognise the limits, and we've got to actually devise a way of accounting for the kind of environmental impact that some kinds of unregulated growth has.
Well, you say we have to, but I mean, what's striking about this particular economic and financial crisis is that the technical problems, if I can put it that way, it seem to be defeating almost everybody. It's not that the world leaders think they are clear about what the choices are. They, at the moment, wonder if they've got a mechanism to actually make any choice.
Well, I entirely agree with you, and that's why, for instance, I'm very interested in a project mounted by the accountancy profession to devise ways of changing the international accountancy rules so that the predictable costs and impacts on the environment of some enterprises can be put on the balance sheet. You see, so much depends on the perspective and the picture that we have. And if we don't have a picture that is really informed by something that's predictable like that, we'll make the wrong decisions.
But we'll still, however well-informed we are, the choices will be difficult. And yesterday, for example, at the demonstration, there was little agreement about priorities. Is it jobs? Is it more equality? Is it ending global poverty? Is it the environment? These aims may not be compatible.
Well, but as we try and rebuild the world's financial system, I don't think that it's for bishops to pose as great experts on economics, but I think that setting the framework in which we have to establish regulation, and the framework for me has to come from an idea that what's good for humanity as a whole must be ultimately coherent and convergent.
But let's, for example, look at the contrast between the need to protect the environment and the need to create jobs. Many would argue that the cost of continuous growth is inevitably, at least in the short term, damage the environment. And actually, in terms of the environment, we should welcome less growth. But of course, less growth, less jobs, and very possibly, if protectionism takes over, even less jobs in the developing world.
But this is not a simple either-or choice, is it? I mean, I've been saying for 10 years, I've been using the same phrase, growth without limit, with no end in view beyond the process itself, is bound to disappoint. Now, that's the point, it seems to me, that we certainly need growth to alleviate the desperate poverty of people with whom I'm very much in touch on a week-by-week basis in Mozambique and Angola. But it's got to be growth that's got our eyes open to the limits, to the scarcity, as one of your previous speakers said. And it's got to be in a regulatory framework which actually forces us to consider these matters and not simply to go ahead with growth at any price.
Now, there's a temptation in the present circumstances for people to, as it were, blame the bankers entirely. Do you think, and some church leaders have been doing this, of course, do you think that's entirely fair?
I think that we've all signed up to it, haven't we? I mean, we've actually been complicit in the last years of fairly unregulated growth in the kind of financial vehicles which have now brought us to grief. So I think that scapegoating is always a cop-out, and it's a very important time for everybody to be re-evaluating their priorities.
Richard Charters, Bishop of London, thank you very much. Now, in the past, homosexuality has been regarded as a disorder that needs treatment. Indeed, some religious organisations still adhere to that view. But mainstream medical opinion is firmly against the idea and the belief that so-called cures are possible, let alone desirable. But a survey of 1,400 mental health professionals published this week found that one in six of them had tried to cure a patient of homosexuality. The author of the report is Professor Michael King of University College London, and he joins me now, along with Michael Davidson from the organisation Core Issues, which supports gay Christians who are trying to change their sexual preferences. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can I turn to Professor King first? Are you surprised by these results? One in six mental health professionals trying to cure a patient of homosexuality.
Probably cure is too strong a word. What they were saying was they were trying to redirect their homosexual feelings or change them to become heterosexual. But the word cure also has a value behind it because it implies and it continues to imply that homosexuality is a diagnosis, and it isn't. As far as we know, it's fully compatible with mental and physical health.
Well, whether or not it's desirable to be gay or not, is there any evidence that treatment can change a person's sexual inclinations, in common parlance, change a homosexual to being a heterosexual?
No. Our gold standard for any treatment in psychology or medicine is the randomised clinical trial. And there's never been a randomised clinical trial of these talking treatments to change sexual orientation. So I would have to say there's no evidence at all.
Can I now turn to Michael Davidson and ask you, you want people not to practice as homosexuals, and you yourself have talked about changing your own inclinations to focus it on heterosexuality. Is there any evidence that that works?
Well, I would argue that there definitely is. One, for example, could go to an early study in 1999, I think it was, when Professor Robert Spitzer, for example, did a study that indicated that some cases of individuals did manage to change and did find greater satisfaction in a heterosexual lifestyle. Now, I think that's important because, of course, Robert Spitzer was one-time president of the APA and was, in fact, the man who was instrumental, amongst other people, of correctly removing homosexuality from the DSM.
Can I have asked Professor Malcolm King to comment on that?
It is. Your speaker's drawn attention to a quite remarkable study. It's quite remarkable because it was so poor methodologically. You're quite right. Professor Spitzer was one of the originators who wanted the diagnosis taken off. But the study he did, he asked for volunteers to be put forward from the therapists who'd been treating them, sometimes many years after they'd had the treatment. There was no before treatment assessment. And he asked them, had they changed? Now, those kinds of evidence are very poor, and usually those kinds of evidence do find change. The more rigorous randomised trials don't. And he found that about 13% said they'd made some significant change. So that's quite remarkable. I would have thought in such a poor study he would have found more.
Mike,
so it implies...
Mike Levinson, could you come back?
The significant thing about his study was that although he himself spoke of its limitations, and it was a retrospective study, as you say, he did in fact call for empirical studies that were prospective. And of course,
sorry, could you tell us what prospective is?
In other words, looking before the change, exploring, working longitudinally to see if change does in fact take place, so that you're not relying on somebody's memory, but you're actually looking to see whether a change takes place. And of course, Professor King will know about the Jones and Yarhouse study published in 2008, which was longitudinal, was prospective and not retrospective, and was not self-reporting. And once again, I believe it was 15%.
Briefly, can you respond to that, Professor King?
Yes, I think I'll just make two points. First of all, we need a randomised trial. Secondly, the people who appear to change are often bisexual to start with, and through various self-control measures push themselves in a heterosexual direction. But my third and most important point is that this kind of discussion continues to regard homosexuality as a disorder, and I think that's damaging in society.
Now, Michael Davidson, that is the crucial point. What is wrong with being gay?
There's nothing wrong with a person choosing voluntarily to identify in terms of the socio-political identity of gay. But that's not to confuse it, or we shouldn't be confusing that with the phenomena of homosexuality. I would say that I have had homosexual tendencies in my life, but I have never identified with gay, with the idea of being gay. And Professor King's organization, the Royal College of Surgeons, is very quick to point out that...
I beg your pardon.
Is quick to point out that anybody who does not want to identify with these gay feelings in those terms has ego dystonic homosexuality. In other words, they have internalized homophobia. I'm concerned that Professor King seems to have not reinforced the APA's position, which argues that people should, or mental health organizations should call on their members to respect a person's right to self-determination. And that's what I want to argue. I believe I have a right.
Professor King, if someone wants to determine their own sexuality, shouldn't people like you assist them in doing so?
Oh, I do absolutely respect your speaker's stance. I mean, anyone can control or change their sexuality in terms of what they do about it. I mean, Catholic priests, they don't need therapists to stay celibate throughout their lives. Of course, your sexuality is your responsibility. I just don't want treatments for which there's no evidence, and I would continue to say that, no good evidence, to be offered out there. Now, the Americans...
Could they be damaging? Do you think such treatments
I think they're damaging. Well, there's a lot of evidence they're damaging, but I can't say that with any real conviction, because only a randomised trial will show whether they're damaging or not.
Michael Davidson, what is implicit here, perhaps, is your view as a Christian that homosexual practice is wrong. Is that your position?
I believe from a Christian point of view it is wrong, but I think what we're dealing with here is two fundamentally irreconcilable understandings of what homosexuality is. Professor King, I believe, is arguing from an essentialist position, which is saying that homosexuality is a fixed identity, that it has some substance, like Homo sapiens, for example. I am arguing from a social constructivist position. The word gay has only been around for 100 years in terms of its association with homosexuality. 100 years ago, it meant something completely different. This is the way today we construct the meaning of homosexuality. I'm not denying its existence.
Sorry, Michael Davidson and Professor Michael King, I hope we can continue this discussion at another time. Thanks very much indeed for joining us. And that's all from this edition of Sunday. In 2 weeks' time, in a special Easter Day edition of the programme, we'll be discussing the issue of spiritual leadership. And we'd like to hear from you about the spiritual leaders, alive or dead, whom you find the most inspiring. Please email us with your thoughts at sunday@bbc.co.uk, or you can write to us at New Broadcasting House, Oxford Road, Manchester, M61SJ. I'll be back at the same time next week, Palm Sunday. From me, Roger Bolton, goodbye.